You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both places. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is philosopher Tim Crane, formerly Knightbridge Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge and now at Central European University. Author of several books, his most recent is The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View, in which he takes a different approach from that of the new atheists and argues that atheists like himself should attempt to understand religion and, as far as possible, attempt to tolerate it. Tim Crane, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Stuart. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you. As I mentioned in the introduction, you're advocating an approach to religion that's different from the so-called new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, who's passed away, and Sam Harris. Theirs is a, I think it's fair to say, a somewhat combative and antagonistic orientation, but I don't want to assume that our listeners today are familiar with them or their work. So I'd like if you'd start, if you would, by just briefly laying out kind of their general orientation, which we can develop through looking at yours. But just to get us started, what can you say about their approach as a background?
Yes, well, I think what's called the New Atheist Movement, it's loosely described as a movement, is a collection of writers who feel very strongly about both the factual content of religious belief and also its effects on the world. So as their views about the content of religious belief, that what religious belief says, is that religious belief is, on the whole, irrational, a relic of an outdated pre-scientific worldview or a pre-scientific way to understand the world, and that based on certain big supernatural assumptions about, you know, reality, about the existence of God and the creation of the world, it's easy to show, on their view, that the factual content of religion is completely false. So that's their view about, you know, what religion says about the world. And then I think the other part of their view is the, as you said, the combative approach to the effects of religion in the world, that most they see what's going on in the world today and they trace a lot of the bad things that are happening back to religious belief and to the dominance of religion in the world. So their overall aim is to eliminate religious belief because they think that life will be better without it. And they try and do that by means of philosophical and scientific argument and rhetoric and persuasion and piling up the evidence. And they've been quite successful in getting their point across.
Well, one of the points you make, though, is that attempt to try to get rid of religion in the world may be a bit of a fool's errand, since the vast majority of people in the world, the vast majority of the over 7 billion people, do believe in religion. And so that's one kind of fact about it. But the other is just a question of whether or not that kind of argument gets at the real issues for religious people. I think you make the point that their view of it is somewhat limited. For one thing, it doesn't take up really much about how religion provides some real meaning for people. So if you'd start to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a striking fact about the New Atheist contribution, although they have a lot of followers, they don't make much impact on the religious themselves. And on the whole, people who've responded to them, religious writers who've responded to them, have tended to say that they've misrepresented the view. So I got interested in this and thinking, how could you get something more like a dialogue between these sides so that people would actually understand what they were really disagreeing about? Of course, no one likes to be told that they're irrational idiots, so maybe that might be part of the problem. But looking at this in more detail, I found myself thinking that one of the things they miss out is, as you say, the element of meaning. How do people find meaning in the world? Now, I think the way that they miss this out, and I'll take Richard Dawkins as an example because he's a particularly lucid writer and a very impressive writer in many ways. But he treats religious belief as if it were a purely theoretical business, that is to say, it's a theory about how the world is, how the world was created, and any attempt to explain that how religion gives your life meaning by Dawkins, it always rests on some sort of view like people want to believe so that they can save their souls. So people have this instrumental desire, to do good so that in order that in the end they can have eternal life or something like this. And it seems to me that's not the way that religious people think. I mean, they're going to have to, in talking in this way, I'm generalizing about the views of billions of people. So obviously there's going to be so many differences here that could be picked up. But I think what I feel about that is that, they started it. They started by generalizing about religion, so I can generalize too. So I think one aspect in which religion gives life meaning is that it sees life as a mystery, and that you don't think that the aim of your belief system is to explain in great detail how everything happened. It's rather that once you commit to a religion, either by choosing it or by being born into it, or once you've committed to it, then the world itself becomes a different place for you. The world contains a kind of significance, but that significance is deeply mysterious. So you don't really think that you've explained things in the way that science explains things. When you've said God will provide, or you said, if it's God's will, it should happen. You don't claim to understand God's will in saying that. You're giving expression to the idea that there's a mystery behind things. And it's trying to align ourselves with this mystery, which is what faith is about, I believe. That's one part of it. I don't know if I should go on to talk about the other side.
Let's follow up on that. The mystery, you talk about it, I think, in two ways in the book. One, you call it, I think it's following William James, right? An unseen order, and also you use the word transcendent. So maybe you could flesh out that kind of mystery in those two ways.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yes. So William James had this very nice, crisp summary in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and where he said that that the essence of religious belief is the belief that there is an unseen order, and that our greatest good is to align ourselves with that order. Now, what does that mean, the unseen order? Well, I the way I see it is that there's the world we see around us, and there's a world as described by science, and let's call that the world of experience, or the empirical world, as philosophers call it. Then the belief that there is an unseen order is the belief that there's something more. There's something more that in some way makes sense of it all. That's why I say that it's a belief in mystery, and that faith is a matter of accepting a certain kind of mystery. I think that, so to say, yes, the word transcendence refers to, literally it means, going beyond. So what transcends is what goes beyond this world, goes beyond the world of ordinary experience and science. Now, the way that Dawkins and others express that is that they'll put it in terms of there being some supernatural agency which makes everything happen in the world. And it's certainly true that, some religious doctrines express themselves in that way. But that makes it look as if God is just one other thing in a sort of bigger reality. Whereas I think that the idea of an unseen order is something much more mysterious. It's much more something like the principles which explain why everything is as it is fundamentally, which somehow makes sense of it to you, not in the way that a scientific law makes sense. A scientific law is just a regularity, but it makes sense in a way that it tells you how things ought to be. So I think that unseen order in the world is explained on this rather abstract conception of religious belief, but I hope the idea is clear. It's explained by the idea that there's more to it than all this. There's more to the world than just these things we see around us. And it's that in which the mystery of the world consists.
Yeah, I'd like you to further elucidate that just a little bit, because we could use the word mystery in a scientific sense, like there are things that are mysterious about the empirical world, and you know, science generates hypotheses to try to figure that all out. But the religious sense of the use of mystery is not quite the same. It's not – one of the points you make is it's not generating hypotheses for testing and experiments, but it's a different sense of mystery, right?
That's right. Yeah. I think the mystery in science is simply a matter of ignorance. And the ignorance may be, our ignorance is limited by our powers of understanding, and it's limited by the amount of knowledge we can actually acquire. But I think the mystery of religious, that's at the heart of religious belief, is not, should not be thought of as ignorance. It's not that if we somehow, from this worldly point of view, had access to God's mind, then we would understand what makes the world tick in every way. It's rather that it's another way of saying that you have to accept the inexplicable and somehow harmonize it in your life. Death, I think, is probably the central, well, phenomenon that ties all religions together. And Heidegger said that this was our distinctive mode of being. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger said that this was our distinctive mode of being, that our human mode of being was always looking towards death. We are the creatures who are aware of our own deaths and structure our lives around that. And I think coming to terms with death is one of the things that religion is trying to do. But it's not by coming up with a hypothesis, a rather specific hypothesis about what's going to happen when you die, because I think all the attempts to say what happens when you die are deeply inadequate, and I think people are not satisfied with them in a way. This is why I think religious mourning is as poignant and as grief-ridden as secular mourning. There's this sense, at a religious funeral, that things are just as tragic. It's not, even if you think this isn't all there is, because you have this sense that you have no idea really what's gone on. You don't really understand what's happened. This person's been taken from you. You'll never see them again. Or you have this hope that you will, which you express in certain metaphorical forms of words and all other forms of words. So I feel that this notion of mystery isn't a matter of our ignorance about some laws or some equations or not having enough data or something. It's rather that it's rather the question of what happens when we attempt to understand the world as a whole and our place in it, and we find we can't. And when I say we, I mean that this is the attempt that people with the religious impulse feel, that they want to. Want to make sense of it all, and to make sense of it all involves facing up to the fact that you can't. Now, an atheist like I am, I think that this is just an unfortunate fact about our ignorance. There are certain things we don't understand, but the death is not particularly. It's just one dreadful thing among others. But it's not something that illustrates anything deep.
So I'd just like to highlight one thing, and it's something else that you do in the book, and it seems to me it is part of what the new atheists focus on. So people who are religious do profess to have certain beliefs. So they profess that they know that or they believe that after death, for instance, they are going to go to heaven, and they do – have beliefs about the creation of the world. And that seems to me what the new atheists tend to focus on and show that those are false. You're trying to also say, yeah, well, the idea of religion is something more than just those, which the new atheists don't focus on. So you could talk about that a bit more, but also the title of your book is about belief, and you do go into belief. And so if you could expand a little bit, as you do in the book, on just what it is to believe something and maybe how we can think of belief in different ways, scientifically and religiously.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I should say, of course, you know, perhaps my last comments, I mean, it seems as if religious people do not believe that there's life after death and all that God created the world. But, of course, you know, many of them do. And that's the question is what it means to believe there's life after death. What do they think they mean by that?
Right.
Which, of course, is a huge question because we're talking about the views of billions of people. But so belief, yes, you see, belief in the sense I'm talking about here is the commitment to the truth of something. So philosophers use the word belief to apply to any beliefs about, you know, how many chairs are around your table, just as much about as how many fundamental particles there are or whether God created the world. So the word belief is used for trivial everyday things as well as for profound and difficult things. But what's in common between those all those cases is that belief is a commitment to the truth of something, something's being so. And that commitment shows itself in partly in what you say and part what you're prepared to say in certain circumstances, but also in what you do, the way you behave. So, you know, to take trivial examples, I mean, you wouldn't cross, no matter how many times you said you thought it was safe to cross the road in downtown Los Angeles when against a green light. No matter how many times you said that was safe to do it, whether you believe it or not will be determined by, you know, whether you do it or not. Right? So, action is the ultimate guide to belief. And to whether to what someone believes, and I think this applies in the religious case too. So, my most general picture of the religion, the heart of religious belief, is the phrase you quoted from William James, the belief that there is an unseen order. And so I don't mean that those words have gone through everyone's mind who believes things, but that's a way of generalizing over the many different kinds of religious belief that there are. So belief is something that is a commitment to the truth of some claim. It's something that governs your behavior, and it's something that you can yourself bring to consciousness, although it's not, sometimes it's harder to bring it to consciousness than you might think. Sometimes we're not the best authorities on what we believe. I just want to make it clear that I do think that, you know, Christians believe that Jesus rose from the dead. I think if a Christian believes anything, they should believe that. That's going to mean very different things for different kinds of Christians. But one of the things that it means is that a certain event happened, and that Jesus did not. Jesus died and then lived again, in whatever sense you want to give to that. And to be a Christian is to be committed, I'd say, at least to the truth of that claim, and so to act accordingly. Now, then what acting accordingly means depends on your particular faith.
Okay.
I don't know if that...
That helps. I want to keep going with it, but just need to remind people that if they're just joining us, they're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is philosopher Tim Crane. He's the author of The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View. You can find out more on the web at considerthis.us or at kzyx.org. So I'd like to keep going on this idea of meaning a little bit. A couple of weeks ago, I had another philosopher on who was also an atheist, and the focus in that particular book and his particular the talk that we did was about meaning. And so it seems to me like you would be sympathetic with his idea that not believing in any transcendent unseen order, that in a way that means that ultimately in some ultimate sense, things aren't meaningful. There's no ultimate meaning for things. He really made the point clearly that doesn't mean things aren't meaningful, but he was really focusing on the kind of interpersonal meaning and the meaning one can have in one's communities and groups. And you do make the point that is part of the meaning in religion, too. You call it identification. So perhaps you could go in that direction with that part of how religion provides meaning for people.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. I agree with what that philosopher says, that there is no ultimate meaning in the world. If you're an atheist, I think you cannot think there's an ultimate meaning in the world. If you don't believe in the transcendent or in an unseen order, as I put it before. So I put that in the book by saying that there is no meaning of life, as it were, although people find meaning in life. I think atheists can find meaning in their life just as the religious can, but finding meaning in that sense is a much more localized, much more personal human thing rather than the idea of a fundamental meaning, which religious belief gives you. So I agree with that. There's meaning in life, but there isn't a one meaning of life, as it were. So I characterize religion broadly in terms of two things in my book. One is the belief in the unseen order, which I've mentioned already. And the other is what I call identification, which is the obvious fact, but I think it's insufficiently emphasized by the new atheists, the obvious fact that a religion isn't just something you believe, it's something you belong to. And belonging means being part of a community that's tied together either across the world in space or in time for generations and generations, practicing your faith with people, meeting together, belonging to that group, which has beneficial consequences for people in the group. And also, it has to be said, it has some bad consequences too, because being a member of the group inevitably means excluding those who are not members of the group, so dividing the world into the damned and the saved, the Catholics and the non-Catholics, the Jews and the Gentiles, the Muslims and the infidels, or however people want to put it. And so this is a very distinctive part of religious belief, without which I think you can't make sense of the phenomenon of religion. It's this phenomenon of identification with others, which involves practice, daily or weekly practice, doing the same things that other people have done with you together for hundreds or thousands of years, but the same things that people have been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. So I think that's a very important part of what gives people's lives meaning. It's religious. And in some religions, it's the main part of it, that the transcendental element is minimized or even perhaps non-existent in some things that count as religions. I'd rather not count those things as religions. I'd rather have the two elements of the transcendental plus the element of identification.
And another point you make, contrary to the new atheists, is that kind of meaning that's provided for people doesn't make them irrational or confused or delusional, that all of that is an important part of the meaning in life for many people, and it's a perfectly understandable response.
Yes, I agree with that. So that's a good description. I think one reason it's understandable is that the element of belonging that gives meaning to people's lives is such a profoundly human thing that the conception I have of religion is that religion is not some rather unfortunate relic of a pre-scientific worldview, which if we had any sense we would dispense from it. It's rather that it is the heart of human history, and that the secular age has tried to dispense with a lot of this, but without, I think, duly acknowledging that this need to identify, this need to belong, is such an incredibly central human thing. I mean, it's so central, it seems obvious to state it, but it's that's one of the hearts, one of the center points of religious belief. Now, I don't think it's irrational to want to belong. That's one thing, and I think it can be a positive benefit to people, the element of belonging gives them. And so in that sense, from an instrumental point of view, it's rational. It can be rational. I don't think it's necessarily irrational to hold cosmological religious beliefs either, to hold beliefs about the universe, to beliefs about the existence of God. I don't think these are irrational beliefs in themselves. I think rationality and irrationality classify the reasons that people get the reasons that people have for believing the things they have, they do, and people can believe things for good reasons or bad reasons. And I believe that many very rational people believe in God for very good reasons, and many perfectly normal people believe in God for similar reasons. And so I think a belief being false is not the, that is to say not true, is not the same thing as it's being irrational.
So how...
As I mentioned, the other things that are involved in this belief can actually bring people a lot of comfort and benefit in their life.
So what would you make of the difference? So let's assume for the moment that people who do, I can't remember who it is, and I think you quote it in the book, something to the effect that having beliefs, you talk about the sacred a bit, and you talk about some of the rituals, and that all of this kind of points towards the transcendent for many people, points to this kind of unseen order. And so if we assume that there is something real there, is it just a matter of their developing some kind of meaning from that, even though you would say that doesn't really exist? Or how would you characterize that kind of impulse towards that and the meaning somebody gained, where somebody who does believe, does have faith, really does have a sense of some ultimate meaning to things? And a more atheistic view, whether that's you or the new atheist, which says that's not real, that's not possible.
Yeah, this is one of the most difficult questions, I think, how to characterize that, that attitude. So if we just go back to something you mentioned, which is the idea of the sacred. Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist, he over 100 years ago wrote about this in a very illuminating way, and I know that there's been a lot of work on the sociology of religion since then, but a lot of it very interesting. But I find Durkheim's insights very valuable. And one of them is that the notion of the sacred is a central notion in understanding religious life and practice. That the world is divided into the sacred things and non-sacred things, or profane things. And sacred things are things that have a certain significance for you. And I describe that significance in the book as you say, as pointing beyond this world, indicating something other than this world, either in a literal way, as when a story, a sacred book or sacred text might describe something about the creation of the world, or in just the significance of a ritual object, as someone might use a prayer shawl or a prayer mat or something could become something that is sacred to them in a way that it's treated with a certain kind of respect that sets it apart from other things. So the sacred things are perfectly ordinary things that are just take on the role of being sacred because of the attitudes that people have and they treat them, treat the objects with. I'm perfectly prepared to say, as someone who thinks there is no transcendent realm, I think it's okay to say, to describe the believer as, having set these sacred rites and objects and texts that point towards a transcendent realm, even though there is no such thing. So I use the word points towards a transcendent realm, even though I don't think there is one. And I'm hoping that the reader will understand what I mean by that, in the sense that you can represent something, or you can desire something that doesn't exist. You can long for something that doesn't exist. You could long for world peace or perfect happiness or something. This will never exist. So in a similar sense, I think the sacred things point beyond themselves to something that, in my view, doesn't exist. But this is the disagreement then between me and the believer, that they think that there is a transcendent realm, and I think there isn't.
Right. Well, as you were talking, one of the things that, it, just to distinguish it, it seems to me that from the atheistic side of things, you can say these rituals and objects, texts, excuse me, point to that realm, even if it doesn't exist, that people, they are sacred because people ascribe that kind of meaning to them. Of course, for the people who are the believers, they wouldn't think of themselves as the meaning coming from their ascription. They would think they really are sacred.
That's right.
There's a lot more in the book, and maybe we'll get to some of it. I do want to open up the phone lines for listener questions in just a bit, but I think we do have to move and make sure that we do cover the another central idea in the book is this idea of toleration and what you think that is, and distinguish it from what some people might think toleration is, some of the false maybe implications of it as an idea, because that I think is another important part of your book. It's really what you're aiming at.
Yes, I mean, that's the second part of the book is really about what practical attitude we should take towards the phenomenon of religion. And here, you know, I have to be very careful because these practical questions and political questions are very different in very different parts of the world. So different things are pressing, different questions are pressing, you know, in Britain or in continental Europe than they are in the United States or in Indonesia or in China. So I'm very cautious in what I say here, but I do believe that in a state that has a strong rule of law, has a strong tradition and a legal system of integrity, say, then I believe that religious practice should and belief should be tolerated in such a state, with it so long as its practices and activities conform to the rule of law. So you can offload all the questions, you know, whether people should be allowed to kill each other for religious reasons. That's the sort of thing that can't be tolerated, and that's the sort of thing that is ruled out by, you know, a proper legal system and a proper morality. What I mean by tolerating, I have got a very simple point I want to make about toleration, but I think it's overlooked in a lot of cases. A lot of people seem to think that tolerating something is just a way of saying, well, you know, anything goes, it doesn't matter, any view is as good as any other. So if you tolerate, say, religious practices or belief as an atheist, that means you think, you know, you think their view is as good as yours, or you think you're not entitled to criticize their view, or you think that all views are worthy of respect or something like that. Right? Now, I want to dispute that. I think the notion of tolerance actually presupposes that you disagree or disapprove with what you're tolerating. So this is why tolerance is a very useful notion, and it's a very important notion in liberal societies, because in liberal societies we allow other people to have different views and different practices. We don't try and impose, we don't try and restrict belief, and we don't try and restrict practice as far as possible within the moral realm of the law and the restrictions that the law, other restrictions the law requires. So a liberal society should be a tolerant society. But what that means is you live with things that you disapprove of. So I have, you know, frivolous examples in my book, like I may have some neighbors who, you know, every year have a loud party or a barbecue or something, and the smell comes into my house, or they keep me up until 4 a.m. with their music, and I don't like their music, but I tolerate them. And I don't tolerate them because I think it's their music is as good as my music, or that it's perfectly okay to let smelly food come into your house. I tolerate it because I want to live in peace with these people, assumingly, you know, I get on well with them and they tolerate me as well. Maybe I do things that annoy them. So the toleration presupposes that you disagree and you disapprove. So I think a tolerant attitude to religion should be combined with a critical attitude to it. So that's the simple point I want to make about toleration. And the other thing I want to say is that it's not true that all views are worthy of respect. I think if you think that adulterers should be stoned, then I think think that view is not worthy of respect, and it should be, and we should fight it with all the power that we have in law and morality, I think. Yeah.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is philosopher Tim Crane. He's the author of The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View. And somebody calling in right now, so we'll go ahead and take the first call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Yes, my name is George.
George, go ahead.
It's interesting to listen to this. I would take the view, and I don't know what's wrong with this view, that religion is sort of a pre-technical software that is sold to the frightened and gullible so that they can answer their questions about their own insecurities. And it's sold to us by people who are basically too lazy to work and have become the priesthood class and the hangers-on to government that use it to manipulate the many of us that are uncomfortable with the observable result of life is that when we die, we rot and become food for small species and plants that eventually become food for larger species and plants and become food for the coming generations of people. And we eat these small things like cows and sheep and yogurt and stuff. And I wonder what's wrong with seeing things in that. How does your guest explain that? And thank you for the program.
Yeah, thanks, George. We'll get his response.
Yeah, thanks, George. I mean, I think the picture I'm trying to paint in this book is painted on a very big scale. I'm trying to generalize about the whole phenomenon of religion, much of which is good, or has been good for humanity, and a lot of which has been terrible for humanity. And religious organizations and cults and faiths have been exploited by unscrupulous and vicious people and have made a lot of people very unhappy. But well, I suppose what I feel about this is that, you know, religious institutions are just as bad as all other human institutions in this respect, and in many cases they're worse. But what I'm trying to do is trying to understand the phenomenon as a whole from the outside, rather than evaluate it. So I'm not a religious man at all, but I suppose I don't agree with what you say as a general description of religion and as to why people are religious, because I think there are many, many reasons why people are religious. Normally religious because they've been born into religious families. So I don't agree with the general story you're painting, although I think in detail, I'm sure you're right, that there are many cases where it's been like that. But I want to emphasize the centrality of religion in the construction of human civilization, and that's been responsible for a lot of the good things in human civilization as well as a lot of the bad things.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This. My guest is Tim Crane. The book is The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View. If you'd like to give us a call and ask a question, the phone number is 707-895-2448. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Yeah, this is Pearl.
Pearl, go ahead.
Hey, I just had a question. It was kind of, it's not really in regard to religion. It's just more of like an atheist perspective of if we have kind of like laws of the universe, and there's like laws of physics. In an atheist perspective, who's behind those laws?
That's a great question. I mean, the atheist has to say no one is behind them. Nothing is behind them. And the philosophical question then is, well, what is a law? I mean, like, if we think of these laws as being like the country, then, of course, you have to have lawmakers and lawgivers and courts and things. But the laws of physics aren't like that. If you're an atheist, there's no lawmaker. So what are the laws? So I think the laws are just regularities in how things behave. That's all they are. They're just these general regularities. So saying that there is universal gravitation is just, you know, it's a mathematically precise way of saying that why it is that things fall to the ground when you drop them. And that's it.
Okay, got another call coming in. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi, I'm David.
David, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with your view that religion does a lot of things for people in societies, and but I'm just wondering, I know this may be outside your expertise, but as far as existentialism goes, what you're supposed to do is realize that life is meaningless and develop your own meaning. But that seems a conflict for me because once you realize that this is more or less a physical world that we're trapped in, I don't know. It just makes it seem morally meaningless. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for someone like that.
Yeah, well, this is obviously the huge question of the atheist philosophy that they have to address that question. If the world itself is meaningless, then how do you make meaning in your life? And as you say, what the existentialists did was that they found one fundamental value, which was what mattered to us was freedom, and that if we could choose freely to do something, that was the form of all our value. So we escape from the shackles of society and just become free by acting on our own wills or desires. Then this is how we make ourselves significant. We mark ourselves off from all the dirt of the earth, as the gentleman before was talking about. So, myself, I don't believe. I think existentialism is a romantic philosophy that is sort of socially unworkable. So I think that you have to find meaning. You have to give up the search for ultimate meaning. I mean, in a way, what the existentialists were trying to do was to replace ultimate meaning in the religious sense with ultimate meaning as given by your freedom of choice. Whereas I think there isn't any ultimate meaning. What you have to do is find meaning in your day-to-day projects, and that's the meaning you're going to find, you know, with your relationships, your children, the things that you find value in from day to day.
Thanks, David.
It's a bit of a low-key answer, but that's the only one. Yeah.
The lines are open. If you do have a caller and you'd like to raise a question or make a comment, phone number 707-895-2448. I want to go back to this idea of respect, because another distinction that you make, and I'd like to just draw it out a little bit more, is in your view of toleration, you may not tolerate some ideas, and you certainly may not respect some ideas, but you make the distinction really, I think you partly attribute it to Kant, this idea of really respect for persons, for the people, that toleration does certainly allow for respect for people.
Yes. Yeah. So I think this is really important. I think this is the truth of the idea that, I don't know, everything's worthy of respect or everyone is entitled to their opinion, and this sort of view that you sometimes hear. Because, I mean, I think if we look at the contents of people's opinions, I don't think it's true that every opinion is worthy of respect. So what is it that's worthy of respect? And here I appeal to Kant, and I say, you know, this is one thing about humanity, is that human beings, each human being, is worthy of respect. Each human being should be respected, even if their views are abhorrent or intolerable or unacceptable in some way. And so what do I mean by respect? I mean, perhaps the best illustration of this, which I give in the book, is what's embodied in the idea that everyone deserves a fair trial. So even a criminal who you know to have committed the crime, in a legal system that embodies the idea of respect, even such a criminal deserves a fair trial, and to be treated as an individual just like everyone else. And this has lots of ramifications. I mean, treating people as simply representatives of groups. You know, one way in which sort of racism and xenophobia manifests themselves is just thinking of someone as a person of a certain kind or a certain race. And one of the great Enlightenment and liberal ideas is that everyone counts for one in and of themselves. So this is the truth I want to find in the idea that, you know, that all views deserve respect. It isn't that all views deserve respect. It's that everybody deserves their autonomy to be respected in some abstract way. Yeah.
Let's take the next call. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Lola.
Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that the fundamental issue or problem is that we do not accept that there's suffering in the world.
Okay.
And that's like the Buddhist concept, that's where we start, is the fact that for everybody, some people would say, well, there is suffering in the world, instead of the very radical belief that if we accepted the premise that living life is suffering, then we could go from there.
Okay, let's get Tim's response. Thanks.
I think in a way I agree with that. I think that's, and I think that the, you know, the source of a lot of religious ideas is the fact of suffering, how to make sense of suffering, and for some people, of course, this is a criticism. This is a criticism of religion derives from this, which is that religion is a way to sort of suppress people's attempts to deal with suffering. Marx's view that religion was the opium of the people, for example, was one of those ideas. But I think how to accommodate the suffering in life, how to make sense of it, how to come to terms with it, how to live with suffering, this is the human predicament, and this is the thing that I would say religious belief is an attempt to address in part.
Got another call.
Yeah.
Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please? Hello?
Hello. Hi, it's Carl.
Carl, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just wondering about the ethics for atheists. It seems like an atheist is just pretending that life matters, and our experience matters somehow. And I wondered if your guest could address the fact that, it seems like such a struggle, why do we not kill each other? If somebody, a similar being, you don't just shoot somebody, but it seems like such a struggle for an atheist to not control himself and not sell somebody short as a human being.
Thanks, Carl.
That's about it.
Got it. Thank you. I think he's raising two.
Thank you. I mean, this is.
Go ahead.
This is of course one of the traditional questions for atheists of how they can account for morality. I don't agree with the question actually, or the presupposition behind the question that it's more difficult for atheists to be moral than for Christians. Although I'm generally a pessimistic person about these things, but in this respect, I'm somewhat more optimistic. I think you see David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher, said that people had a natural sentiment of benevolence towards others. Now, you could say whether this benevolence was instilled in them by God, but you could just say it's a natural trait among us, like the way that we care for our children. Or that we're repelled by suffering. You know, we see someone suffering, and we feel the urge to do something about it. Even Christians, I think many Christians will accept that there is such a natural sentiment of benevolence towards others. So I think I don't really see this as a pressing question. Given the number of atheists in the world, and if my rough, very rough figures in the book are correct, there's about a billion atheists, billion and a half atheists in the world, and they're not all going around killing each other. In fact, you know, rather depressingly, it's a lot of the religious people are the ones going around killing each other. So I think we have to look at the question of religion and morality separately. I think morality is totally understandable independently of religion.
Yeah, you made the point of Hume, but there's a whole tradition in ethics of secular approaches to thinking of ethics and different kinds of moral standards. So there really is a rich tradition there. I'm going to go ahead and take another call here. Yes. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead.
I apologize for my phone line.
No, we can hear you okay.
If I can go back just a little bit, I greatly appreciate your thesis and your intention. I always liked Bucky Fuller's concept of the a priori universe. And so that leads me to ask you about the psychological interpretation of all of this, if that isn't a way to secularize the religious issue with the notion that everybody has to explain the other. The outside universe.
Yep, great. We'll have Tim give you a response. Thanks.
I do have a question.
Thanks for the question. I couldn't quite. Sorry.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a few thousand miles away. So, Stuart, could you repeat
my question,
please?
If atheism sees itself as adversarial to a petitionable God, someone that people in their minds can address and feel better about, is it not also possible to address the universe in some fashion through action, through whatever spontaneous, really, expression in a healthy way? You know, hate the universe for that matter, but in addressing that, get into the what I think Joseph Campbell talked about, a mythological kind of life where one knows that's what one is doing.
I think we got the gist of it. We're getting down to the end of
Thank
the hour,
you.
So I'm going
to
have
–
no, that's all right. Thanks.
Yeah.
Did you get that, Tim?
Yeah, I got that. Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think in some sense you can't I don't think you can literally address the universe like you can address a personal God. So I don't think, but there are these views that think of the universe in a mythological way, and I don't have much to say about those views, I'm afraid. Thanks. It's a very interesting question you're raising. I think the first point, I think you said something about our attempt to encounter the other, and I think this is a very important aspect of what gives rise to religious experience. I don't know how much time we've got, Stuart. Whether it's
we've got about a minute or so, so you can respond, and I'd also like to give you an opportunity to just kind of finish up anything you'd like to say in closing. One thing I would like to just highlight, going back to something you said at the beginning, it seems to me that part of your intent here in trying to elucidate a slightly different vision of religion is really to promote dialogue and promote communication and promote understanding among people, because religion isn't going away.
Yeah, that is exactly one of my hopes. It's an ambition I have, yeah. I think there are lots of areas of knowledge where people are talking among themselves, and there are lots of communities of discussions of things to do with religion and religious belief where people are just failing to interact with others with very different views. And I think if you found something and you think you want to object to it, you better find out what it is first and not just imagine that you know what it is. And I would hope that the aim, I mean, this would be a very grand hope and not something you can achieve by writing a book, but I'd hope that there's some possibility that people can live in peace and that living in, aim of toleration is peace. The aim of toleration is not to get a harmony of views. It's not to constrict people's minds or to make people all think the same bland, watered-down liberal truisms. It's the aim is to live in peace with people. Live in peace with people with whom you disagree and of whom you disapprove. And at the moment, this is not as easy as it should be, or as it should be, as it could be, perhaps.
Yeah. Tim, thank you very much for joining us today. My guest has been Tim Crane, author of The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist Point of View. Really thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Stuart. Thanks for having me on. It's been very enjoyable.
Thanks. Bye-bye.